This week on Harmonia, I'm talking with Anne Azema, director of the Boston Camerata. Welcome to Harmonia.
Thanks for having me.
I'd love to talk about the history of the Boston Camerata, which is one of the longest-lived and most successful early music ensembles in the world. In fact, you know, being from Massachusetts myself, I can remember the Camerata's concerts being a major inspiration for me as a young person wanting to pursue early music. And I wonder if you could say a little bit about the history.
I think the Camerata has been an inspiration for many of us here in America and even abroad, you know. The Camerata was started, interestingly enough, as a reach-out educational venture at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston in 1954. It was founded by Narcissa Williamson, a woman who was working in the education department at the MFA. And I think her wish was that those beautiful early instruments that were behind glass cases in the museum would somehow get a life and start sounding, and that the collection would have an arena to be able to be played and shared with the public. That was in 54. And then by 1974, a young American composer was introduced to the Camerata as a lute player. And when he came back from studying with Nadia Boulanger, he was offered the direction of the Boston Camerata, who then came out of the MFA. His name was Joel Cohen, and the rest is history. Mm-hmm. And then a few years after that, a European singer living in America was offered the directorship, and then I came in.
The Boston Camerata had an incredibly busy year in 2011. Do I understand that you did 5 tours?
We did. We did indeed. That's one of our busiest seasons. And I must say, there is something extraordinary in being able to travel so much with our productions and also continue within our mission, of course, to share so many different repertoires, because I think what makes us unique in a way, aside from the longevity of the group, is the fact that we are presenting so many different repertoires, that we have reached out in many directions. And so in the tours that we did this year, we started in February with an Americana tour, performing a commission by the Cité de la Musique in Paris of a program based on patriots and American heroes on the foundation of the Young Republic. Then we followed with a tour in again with Americana, and more specifically with Shaker Songs, in collaboration with the Teero Saarinen and a dance company all over Europe, from Finland to Holland via Germany and France, of the ballet that Teero Saarinen conceived on Shaker Songs that we've been performing. We will reprise this performance next July 2012 at a return at Jacob's Pillow Festival in Western Massachusetts. And we have other projects for 2013 of that same production, which has now toured 4 continents. And I think we've performed it over 60 times now. And then we continued with more Americana, believe it or not, returned to France with another repertoire having to do with secular and non-liturgical spiritual American music. Then we did some medieval music, because medieval music is also a great part of our repertoire. It's always been part of the Camerata repertoire, but you may know that I look upon this repertoire with a very keen eye. This is where I developed my performing life as a singer. It's a repertoire that's dear to my heart. Then we returned again with another Americana tour, again with Borrowed Light, with the Teero Saarinen and company, and on and on. And I must say, I'm very proud of the way that we are out there in the world. There's nothing more more challenging and more demanding than to share all these repertoire with very different public, from, you know, Turku in Finland to the south of France or to Maine in America. Mm-hmm. Very different people, very different background, and the same music. It's very interesting to see how it goes.
I was very interested in that when I was reading about these programs. I'm interested to know how an American early music group is received by a European audience in Europe, especially in terms of some of these programs. For example, you mentioned the one about patriots and American heroes. And what were your observations about how it was received?
I may want to share two things on this question, which is a very relevant one and a good one. The first one is that a lot of the early music world was developed in Europe thanks to American luminaries. Mm-hmm. Tom Bingley is one, but there are others after him. So there's always been vivid bridges between America, American academia, and American performers, and the early music world in Europe. The second thing I wanted to share is that the very first time that the Boston Camerata sang American music, it was when we were invited by the Théâtre de la Ville in Paris. And the director of the Théâtre de la Ville had given kind of a carte blanche to Joel Cohen, the director at the time, saying, hey, we know you, just come and do us a concert. And Joel was in the middle of really taping very intensively American music at that time. It was in the late 90s. And I remember that we came in the hall, which was filled up to the rim, and there was a bit of a tension in the hall, actually. And you could feel that people were like, well, what is that American music? There were a bit of worry, in a way. And we started singing, and within 3 minutes, it's as if the hall, as a giant muscle, had completely relaxed and let go and said, oh, that's what it is. We love it. We like it. We can understand it. And when we did Patriots and Heroes, Saw Ye My Hero, the program that the Cité de la Musique commissioned for us in February, I told the director of the hall right away, you know, let's do what we've done last November in Boston, which is this art being participatory in its essence. The public will need to, at some point, be with us, make music with us, and dance at the end, dance with us. And the director of the hall said, oh, well, honey, that's good for Americans, but, you know, you're in Paris. I said, well, let us try. We tried, and we did it. And they danced with us at the end, and they got a fuller picture of what music and music making and a cultural event in the late 18th century, early 19th century America might have been like.
It's so wonderful when you can get an audience involved that directly, and they have such a personal experience of it with the dancing and so on. It's just wonderful.
I think this is a landmark of the Boston Camerata. For these concerts, we push the envelope a little bit, if you will. But in general, like Narcissa Williamson, in a way, in the 50s, for us, music is not something to be admired in a glass case, you know, with a very careful and very precious way of taking care of it. We need to get out of the glass case. And we live in an era when it's absolutely crucial that we share this music as a living thing, as it was then, 1250 or 1790. And that the public has a part in it. Mm-hmm. And that's where the Camerata's work, I think, is fascinating to me. And the challenge is, but also the vision for the seasons to come, is that the concert arena where you have artists on the stage far, far away sharing with you the most beautiful and precious thing is not enough. It's necessary, perhaps, up to a point, but then sharing and asking the public to take part and to reflect with us, be moved with us, sing with us sometimes in some of our programs, move with us in other programs, or be witnesses is a very important part of our work. And I believe deep down that that's where we'll bridge with new eras of music making.
That's so wonderful, and it leads me right to the next thing that I wanted to ask you about, which is the medieval music, because you mentioned that that was especially dear to you. And I know that in addition to your work with the Camerata, you've also done a number of recordings collaborating with instrumentalists such as Shira Kamen and so on medieval music. And that whole idea of presenting it as kind of living art is something that I think you do so well, and I wonder if you would talk about medieval music and making that music alive to your audience as well.
Well, again, there are perhaps a couple of ideas to share. I think that early music became part of our music picture in general, in America and in Europe, when some generations past were looking for another way to share their music making, other way than the mainstream music making, symphony music or chamber music, quintets and so forth and so on, or choral music. And the discovery of older repertoire and the ability to be able to present these older repertoire in concert was a thrill for them. It was incredible, and it's their work is essential for what we can do today and what we'll do tomorrow. For medieval music, I think, again, all the work that you need to do to approach this repertoire, like you would an instrument in the glass case, we're back to the same image, is needed. In other terms, you do need to know what's the facture, how it's made, the structure, the poetic structure, the language approach, the historical context, the music context, the cultural context, and so forth and so on. But once that work is done, and once that that is in place, and you've made your choices, editorial choices, and so forth and so on, what it boils down to is that as women and men of 2012, the thrill is that we are only but a part of a long chain of human experiences. And those poems and this music speaks to us as vividly as passionate women and men as it did to people of 1250 or 1310. What's interesting is that you can share with people today via this music the same passions, the same pains, the same joys, the same need to transcend your own limitation as a human being. And for me, this repertoire carries it in a very powerful way, in its shape, in its form, and in its music, in its energy. So that's the thrill for me, is to discover that we haven't changed that much. And we can enjoy texts and musics which were developed then and were conceived then and were performed then. And it speaks to our heart and our soul in such a powerful manner.
Thank you. So beautifully said. Perhaps we should take a moment to talk about some of the sound files, some of the musical excerpts that
sure.
you've brought.
I missed something when I talked about the five tours, which is I missed the Reims residency, where we were invited to feast the 800th anniversary of the cathedral. And the festival in Reims and the town of Reims commissioned us for five new programs to honor their cathedral. We did the Machaut Mass there and a couple of other secular programs, Machaut and Gauthier de Coincy as well for secular music, Thibaut de Champagne. And we have some music already in our discography to illustrate some of that. For example, D'Outre Dounon, de la Vierge Marie from Thibaut de Champagne.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's pretty amazing as an American ensemble to be invited to feast this jewel of French architecture and this center of French music that Reims was. the 12th and 13th century.
Yes, it's
so
a great honor.
Proud.
It's a great honor.
It's a great honor, and I'm very proud that we were able to do that.
Well, I'm thinking maybe what we should do now is play the music.
Good. This is the piece called The Harvest Hymn by Jeremiah Ingalls. Jeremiah Ingalls was published in Exeter, New Hampshire. So he's a Northeast composer, and it's excerpted from the Christian Harmony. The harvest of souls at the Last Judgment is a very frequently used theme in early American secret song, and this tune is probably derived from an English type tune, but the treatment is absolutely American.
The fields are all white, the harvest is near, the reapers are with their sharp sickles appear to reap down their wheat and gather in barns, while wild plants of nature are left for to burn. To reap down their wheat and gather in barns, while wild plants of nature are left for to burn. Come then, O my soul, and think on that day when all things in nature shall cease and decay. The trumpet shall sound, the angels appear to reap down the earth, both the wheat and the tare. The trumpet shall sound, the angels appear to reap down the earth.
Isn't it interesting, all of those wonderful octaves and fifths?
That's where, for me as a European, when I first heard that, it's like if the house had fallen on me, because it was in a way so reminiscent of earlier polyphonies. At the same time, clearly atavistic. I mean, clearly American.
Mm-hmm.
I never came back from that shock. So you were asking me earlier about how is an American ensemble received in Europe. I'm definitely a European. I was brought up in Europe. I now live in America. But it's clear that you do have these bridges inherent in the music as well. And one feeds the other. I find that fascinating in many of these American pieces, that you have those bridges with the old world. And what's also interesting is that the work of the Camerata started on those bridges very early on. Because if I recall correctly, Joel Cohen developed New Britain probably in the late 70s, where already he was looking for these roads in between, mm-hmm. and above above the puddle. And successfully so, actually. And I remember when the early music movement was sort of looking for itself and in a way was interested in developing only parts of the repertoire very well. And there is it's good to do that. But I do keep a very deep joy in having your looks set on several repertoires at the same time. And one feeds the other, if mm-hmm. you want.
Mm-hmm.
And what you learn on one repertoire may very well help another, and sometimes do more than help, you know.
Yeah.
So it's an ongoing conversation with us that to keep an eye and an ear on all these different repertoire is probably what's fed all of it so well.
What you're saying about the shock of recognition happens the other way around, too, because as Americans, some of us who grew up, you know, singing hymns in churches and so on and so forth, and then the first time we hear this medieval music, we think, wait a minute, there's something in there. It's definitely different, but at the same time, there's something in there that I identify with. There's something in there that feels familiar to me, and that interesting exchange works both ways.
I have, to illustrate this point, I have from Traveling Home, number 25, Ontario, which is based on a theme that's very dear to me, which is the theme of travels and journeys. I've developed several programs around that. distant haven. Alexander is also developed around travels and voyages. Ontario is a piece which is an American piece, but you will recognize another piece presented before, even though it's printed in America in that form. And it comes from the Mennonite hymnody repertoire. And I believe it comes actually from Elkhart, Indiana.
Yeah, that would make sense, that Mennonite, yeah.
Yeah, Elkhart, Indiana, from the Philharmonia, published there in 1875. Perhaps we could listen to Ontario.
Yes, please.
My days on earth pass swiftly by. I'm traveling to my home afar. Jerusalem in glory folded, whose walls are founded by our God, cemented with the covenant's blood, and now are reigning robes of gold.
It's so interesting how, when we contrast that with the previous one, with this one you get that beautiful chorale texture.
Absolutely. But I have another example, if you want,
sure,
a Scottish connection, which is less square and less,
sure,
much more American.
Scots, why hae we Wallace bled? Scots, wham Bruce has often led. Welcome to your gory bed, or to victory. Now's the day and now's the hour. See the front of battle hour. See approach proud Edward's power, chains and slavery. What will be a traitor knave? What can fill a coward's grave? What say base has be a slave? Let him turn and flee. What for Scotland's king and law? Freedom's sword will strongly draw. Free man stand or free man fall, let him follow me.
Soldiers of the cross, arise.
Is that second piece from the Scottish tradition, or is that, it
sounds... No, that's an American
piece. I was just going to say, that sounds like an American shape note hymn to me.
So we heard Scots Wha Hae, which is from Scotland, 18th century, sung by William Hite, which is the Scottish piece that is fairly well known. And then we heard Bruce's Address from the New Harp of Columbia in Nashville, 1867, an American piece, with those beautiful crossing of the tenor and the top, and those very square ways of creating polyphony, which indeed comes from England, where we had the trio, the favorite trio in England, tenor, tenor, bass. And then once in America, that got developed, tenor, tenor, bass, added with women, of course, because this is America.
Mm-hmm.
And then an alto voice developed as they went along.
It's so interesting, that particular style of early American hymnody and also the shape note singing. It's interesting how it's associated in some cases with Southern America, and yet with the shape note singing, you have this flourishing practice of that up in New England. But now it's, you have groups that take part in singing this all over the country. There's a group apparently down here in West Texas that meets regularly to sing these things. So it's become a real American phenomenon as well.
I think it's wonderful. I think this is this country's repertoire, and mm-hmm. it should be, as you know, part of the regular music making. And if we've taken part in trying to raise attention and bring it back, I'm very proud of it.
And you have. It's wonderful.